a lot of journalists like wondering, oh, who is the State of Podcast? And one of the reviews was, I absolutely love this podcast. The best thing about this is I have no idea what the name of the host is, and he doesn't have a Wikipedia page, and there is no profile about him anywhere.
Yeah. You know, we have the old school model of, you know, you're in one band, and it was a big thing when we first came through of, you're in one band, and you don't go play with other bands. Mm. That's like almost like cheating, you know. It is. It's the heartbreak thing of, I can't believe that you're going to go play drums with our friend's band. That breaks my heart. You know, it's tribal. More and more that's happening. But beyond that, it's like, actually, if you want to survive, and you're just, let's say, the saxophone player in a band, you need to play with it. Everyone. Yep. You need to play with as many people as you need to do as many sessions as you can do. Actually, you kind of need 5 sessions a week followed by a tour with a big band to survive.
Absolutely. It is surprising. It's eye-opening. That's the biggest thing I'll take away from this, is that, you know, interviewing all these people and just presuming they all live in, you know, they live good lives and that kind of thing. But, you know, there's people I know who, I've been around their house and they live a very comfortable life, but they're like, their office is, you know, their day-to-day desk job is playing stadiums. And it's just like, oh, you know, it seems unfair to me. Mm. It actually seems unfair to me.
But it's only maybe because, this is maybe where we're wrong, that maybe if you do something that you love, you know, the old model was 1% will be millionaires and everyone else will be devastated. Yeah. And now maybe we do have 10%.
True.
10% will make some money. 1% will be millionaires, probably less than that now. Mm. And the other people won't be devastated because you can upload your music directly to Spotify. Yeah. You can create a podcast if you want and put it straight up. And maybe the hard edge of the industry is going, but also the big bracket of people who can earn real money is going as well.
Do you see any issues around like saturation of people creating music and too much?
Well, it is
music
huge
being out there, because it's great. So firstly, it's amazing people having the opportunity to express themselves, and, you know, from someone who does, you know, I do a lot of work around well-being and stuff like that, you need to have a creative outlet. That's absolutely great. From a listener point of view, I would say in the last 10 years, if I loved an album, I haven't listened to that album 100 times, whereas probably earlier on in my life I would listen to an album 100 times. Do you know what I mean? Like, my a time to listen to music is diminishing, not because I have less time to listen to music. It's just there's so much of different stuff out there. And I just wonder how you feel about that and whether you have a similar experience. There's so much music out there at the moment. It's just keeping you up to date with it and keeping abreast of it is so difficult sometimes.
Well, I've just worked with some acts recently on the industry side, not performing side, where the music's fantastic, great bands. And sometimes the lyrics are like to the level where I wouldn't put that out. You know, it's not quite to what I wouldn't be comfortable singing that, because it sounds a bit like it's been half finished. But the lyrics in terms of themes are kind of in the right spot, you know, sort of generic statements. And the song does really well on Spotify. It flies because the song's great, the melody's great, if the vibe's good, it's been pitched in at the right level. But lyrically, it's not great. And you get back to the argument we have in the 60s when Bob Dylan came through, where people are like, oh, listen to the lyrics. The lyrics are more important than just stop putting music on in the background and engage.
Yeah.
And the same thing's happened again. It's actually mobile phones, technology. We don't want to engage.
Yeah.
It does. If the lyric sounds fine and is uplifting, it's okay.
Yeah.
And there's a hardcore, I'm one of them, there's a hardcore group of people are going, this isn't good enough.
Yeah.
We've just been through, you know, since Bob Dylan, we've been going through this whole period of music as an art form that can elevate and can inspire and to, you know, go back to the 60s and look at what Bob Dylan's contribution to the civil rights movement as a young white Jewish guy was enormous, and loads of other people, enormous contributions as well. You know, there's a place for art right now in where we are. There's a place for music right now. There's a place for songs right now and lyrics right now. And we seem further away from it than ever in terms of everything's about a bit of background music and a playlist and something. Yeah. And I'm not criticising that. I don't think that it's very easy to go, well, Spotify's destroyed people listening to whole albums.
Yeah.
Music was always going to change. Streaming was always going to change things. But I do think the power of a song is lost at the moment.
Yeah.
And I wonder how that's going to come back. Because right now, you look at the political scenario that's happening,
mm-hmm.
there's place for powerful songs. There's place for powerful messages based to songs. There's a reason advertising companies use, you know, Just Eat or whatever.
Mm.
We ordered Just Eat the other day, and as we ordered it, my friend went, "Somebody say Just Eat," as I brought the app up, because it's like, so music's powerful, you know, like music attaches things to things. And I think that ultimately there's a gap. There's a big, big gap. And it's just interesting. Like, I think if you talking to people who are on the edges of that, who aren't actually songwriters, who don't have that effect, but still know all of this stuff and see the industry, and then sit there maybe as a bass player or maybe as the keyboard player, who in the 60s, they'd be very influential. And now it's a gig.
Yeah.
Now it's a job. How much are you getting paid for the gig tonight? And then when's my next job? Do you want me on the album? Am I touring? Are you going to get someone else in? You hear all these horror stories of like people like Duffy firing their entire bands at the end of a tour.
Yeah. McCartney, I heard recently, he'll do a jam at the beginning of a session and get everyone to sign off and say everything that's played belongs to me.
I've heard that about some other people from bands that you've interviewed as well, right, but we won't go into that now. But just moving on, we touched on some incredible interviews that you've done, but what, I mean, aside from really the big insights into some of the, you know, celebrities like Bowie and big insights into amazing artists, like what really stands out? Is there something that's not on your normal level of like, it was amazing to talk about this person, but what stands out in the last 5 years from the podcast in terms of like just a day that you had?
A day that I had? So Rome a couple of years ago, I mean, firstly, the first part of that question, you know, yes, there's loads of people I could explore. Kind of Ezra Furman was fascinating to interview. Lots of other people. But in regards to a day, I always say this to people, the best day of my life and the worst day of my life was the same day. And it was related to the podcast. So I had the opportunity to interview Russ Pritchard, who was the Zootons bassist and played on and co-wrote Valerie. And is also now Noel Gallagher's bassist. And he invited me and said, look, come to Rome when we're playing with U2. And I was actually kind of part of Noel Gallagher's official touring party for that weekend. Went with my best mate, Steve. We flew out there and amazing first night me and Steve had. And we went to the hotel that Russ was staying at and the rest of the band was staying at. And it's this incredible hotel, like on this beautiful kind of hill in Rome. Get there, meet Russ for the first time. Get on like a house on fire. Start this interview, begin the interview with a Partridge quote, which is he actually absolutely loved. And we got on like a house on fire, and it was just a really beautiful interview. And still now, there'll be people listening to this who listen to the Russ Pritchard interview, and that's always often people will say that's their favourite, one of their favourite episodes. And actually years later, when I met Jess, who has played our Groucho Night, when I said, oh, me and Russ really got on well with that, she went, yeah, I could see you two getting on well. And he said, there's a real connection there. It was great. We finished the interview. And then he said to me, oh, Mikey, from the very first episode, is outside by the pool. He said he wants to kind of catch up with you. I said, oh, great. So before the interview, I was a little bit like kind of, it's not nervous, it's kind of apprehension, but I wasn't very hungry and I realised I'd not eaten anything. I said, look, I'll go and meet you and Mikey by the pool in kind of, you know, half an hour. I want to get some food with Steve. So we're sitting by the pool, we order some food. As we're waiting for the food, we can see Gem from Oasis and Noel's band just sat there and we're like, oh, fuck. You know, and this is a real big deal to us. You know, these are people that we kind of really looked up to, and we would see Gem, you know, playing stadium gigs with Oasis and playing this Gibson Firebird guitar that was always his guitar that I always played air guitar along to and wanted to have a go on. And as we were sat there, we get this message on my Facebook Messenger saying the manager of my band had been a manager of our band for many years and kind of had been very loyal to us and supported us through absolutely everything, unfortunately lost his life that morning. And it was like this moment of like, oh my God, we're surrounded by this beautiful place in Rome, these beautiful people, and kind of hearing the absolutely crashing news. And me and Steve kind of looked at each other. He'd been, you know, the person who kind of taught me guitar in the first place. And it was a very kind of profound moment, and it really kind of, it aligned what we were thinking that weekend was. So we're then kind of trying to digest this news. We haven't got much news about what happened, really. And we then are invited to go around to the pool after we'd eaten. And this beautiful moment, like, imagine, like, you're a fan of a band, etc., etc. And Mikey was there, and he was being really complimentary about the podcast, about what we do, why we exist. And then this, you know, Gem comes around, and Gem, again, a bit of a hero of ours, very much a hero of Steve's, walks around, and both Russ and Mikey went, look, we're going to get him on your podcast. We're going to sell your podcast to him. And this is just a dream situation. So I'm just stood there and they're telling him about the podcast. And he goes, no, I don't really know what podcasts are. I'm not interested. And I said, look, Steve Cropper's been on the podcast. Tony Visconti's been on. And he was like, right, I'll drive to you. Within a minute, he put his hand out, said, I'll drive to you and let's do an interview. We then, you know, he agrees to do the interview. Fantastic. When we get back to London, we walk away and we're on absolute kind of cloud nine walking away. We're going to go to the gig. We're on the guest list of Noel Gallagher at a U2 show at Rome's Olympic Stadium. And we go straight to the stadium, get to the venue. We're the only people on the guest list. And as Steve is checking to find out if the tickets were backstage or not, which is the first thing you always do in that situation, I get a message saying Joel, our manager, who died that morning, had taken his life and had been found hanged in his apartment in Portugal. And there had been a long period of weeks before he'd been found. So we are now digesting that horrific information. Absolutely sapped us, took everything out of us. Not knowing how to process any of that, feeling quite ill about the whole thing, and our reflections and our memories of Joel, and, you know, what, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that I, you know, without Joel, we wouldn't have been in the position that we were in that day. 100%. He was very much on my musical education and was a very important figure on that journey. So we're walking into the stadium. We go and see Noel's band support U2. They sounded fantastic. So it was this great kind of mini high again where they sounded, it was the, I remember saying to Steve, it was like the tightest I'd ever heard, like a Gallagher band sound. Like Chris Sharrock had just joined on drums as well, and they just sound absolutely shit hot and really tight. 45-minute show, kind of in a bit of a daze, but enjoying it, but kind of processing what just happened. And then we were like, right, we need to go for a beer before U2 and just talk about Joel. So we went and did that, discussed it. You know, it's not something you ever process very easily. Go back into the stadium, watch the second half of U2 show. No, not a massive fan of U2, but, you know, there it was the Joshua Tree tour. So it's like an incredible, stadium kind of exhilarating performance, whether you like the music or not. It was very stark and memorable. So we then are taking lots of photos because it's so, there's so much imagery that goes with their shows. They, in fact, so Russ messaged me afterwards saying, like, the screen that they had was the highest definition screen that had ever been built to that size.
Yeah, I heard that about that tour.
Yeah, it was incredible. So we're taking so many photos that our phone battery dies. And we decide to walk back in from the stadium to the centre. We'd not eaten anything for a while. So we were going to sit and have dinner, processing what happened. We'd had like quite a big high in the morning and in the afternoon mixed in with like the biggest low you could. But we were still in this weird like, oh my God, that was amazing today at the same time as like, this is the worst thing ever. Eat a meal till like 3 o'clock in the morning, go back to the hotel or the Airbnb, plug in our phones, and because both of our phones had died, no battery. And Steve was like, oh, I've got a load of missed calls from your wife. And I checked my phone and it was like, yeah, I've got the same. And it was basically a message saying that she wanted to divorce me and I'm now divorced.
What a day.
Yeah. that was the day that kind of, you know, Rome is somewhere that always kind of sticks to me. And yeah, that was the day that was kind of like the day of probably the most kind of profound day of my life. And it was entwined with all stuff that was going on professionally and, you know, the podcast and personally and Joel and my whole, and, you know, I've been with, you know, my wife for 17 years, and by that stage I was only 34, so, you know, half my life. So it's a really, really big deal. And it was, yeah, just such an enormous day. And, strange to kind of reflect on it. Russ rang me the next day, so I kind of messaged him the next day, just went, oh, like, this happened as well yesterday, by the way. And he rang me the next day, bless him, what a top guy, like, absolute, like, true scouser through and through, you know. And
I mean, that's a serious day out in Rome, isn't it?
Yeah. And so Rome is always, that's my battle scar, if you like. Do you know what I mean? That's my kind of battle scar. And that's, but genuinely, there are, if someone said, what was the best day of your life? Some of that experience was absolutely euphoric that day.
Some of it's tied in with that day.
Honestly, yeah. Honestly, elements of that day were purely euphoric. And other elements were just the lowest you could ever be. And yeah, I mean, that's a long time ago now. And thankfully, my life has moved on. And you
what
know,
episode of the podcast were we at that point? Do you know?
I don't know. So it's the one I released with Russ Pritchard. And just, you know, and then going on from that. So Gem then agreed to come on the podcast. And that's when the podcast went to number one on the international iTunes charts.
Wow.
Because it was the first interview he'd done in 5 years. And he'd had a serious brain injury in that time. Mm. Which, in retrospect, I think was the reason why he was reticent from doing interviews. And I think that's why it was useful for him to have kind of, you know, people like Mikey and Russ at the time say, no, you know, Chris is sound, he'll look after you. And I always say to everybody, nothing will go out unless you want it to go out. So they have, you know, essentially final edit of it, if you like. And so I went round to Gem's house, which was just insane. You know, this is someone who, you know, probably the most defining concerts of my life were when I was kind of 16 or 17, Wembley Stadium, two nights in a row, went both nights. And he played this Gibson Firebird. And I remember kind of when I first played guitar, my air guitar was to play this guitar. So we went around his house and he had the fucking guitar there. He had the guitar there. And I just mentioned to him, I said, that's a legendary guitar. He said, is it really? And he's been really modest about it. He said, oh, you can play it if you want. And so I actually played the guitar, which we've used as the image for this particular episode. And if you see me smiling in this, it's because he used it on a video for a song called Go Let It Out. And I decided to play Go Let It Out on this guitar. Because what else are you going to play? Like, I felt like I had to do it. And it's when he goes, are you playing Go Let It Out? It's like, and I turn around laughing. I'm going, yeah. It's, and that was an incredible, special day. This was a number of kind of, maybe a month or two afterwards, to get Gem to do that. Met him again recently. So Jess, who's also Noel's band, asked me to introduce her band and host a gig that they were doing. Unfortunately, I was flying in from Belfast. And my flight got delayed, meaning I couldn't do that. But I still turned up to the latter part of the gig, saw Gem and said, let's get a photo. And he said, I said, let's get a photo for old time's sake. And he said, no, let's do it for new time's sake. And I looked and I realised in at Belfast Airport, on the tarmac as I was walking, there was loads of rain and my hair had gone really, really bad. And so I started to do my hair. And then Gem kind of said, no, I'll do your hair for you. And he started doing my hair for me for this photo. And it was a great photo from kind of a few months ago. But that was just kind of a period where it was like, the most kind of difficult day of my life, and also, like, you know, a euphoric day that then led to something, you know, then the podcast went to number one because of that day. Like, it was...
I mean, and a great insight for podcast listeners that have, you know, some of the emotional journey that you've been on through these years of doing the podcast, you know, and it's, I think that's, it's really, really interesting. I mean, just to, like, just to wrap up with a few more guests, just to finish off on a couple more guests, because we're getting towards, like, where you are now. And I think it's I think just before we finish and look at where we're going next, I mean, people like Ed Blaney, for example.
Yeah, man.
Ian Brody, Ian Dench from EMF as well. Some great interviews recently. But someone like Ed, Mark Riley was in The Fall, who bass player in The Fall, mm-hmm. who helped launch our career.
Really? I didn't know he...
He actually played...
He played a bit of your stuff.
Very, very quick story about Mark Riley. Mark Riley emailed, messaged us on MySpace. And he had no profile picture. And it was Mark something, Mark like 9972 or something. He went, "Hi, it's Mark Riley from BBC. I love this song. How do I get a copy of it? Send me a copy of it. I want to play it on my radio show. And do you want to come up to Manchester and be on the show?"
Wow.
We didn't reply. Because we're like, we just thought it was bullshit. It's like someone with no profile picture, with no followers, why would he message us on MySpace? And MySpace shows you how long ago this was.
Yeah.
It was actually Mark Riley. And then he messaged again, and then we did reply. And we did, he played our single on the show, and we went and did his show up in Manchester, and that launched our career. Anyway, Mark was in The Fall, famously. Lots of people have been in The Fall, but to interview someone who's been in The Fall, to interview Stuart Lee, whose obsession is The Fall, and Ed's, you know, managed The Fall.
Yep.
Like, I mean...
So Ed talks about on that interview being with Mark E. Smith at the moment of his passing.
Yeah.
And the last kind of conversations. Ask you
about. So...
And that was a very... that was a difficult thing to address, and it's something that he offered up. In fact, I didn't know that information. I knew how close they were, that they'd worked together in lots of different ways. So firstly, Ed's a really good songwriter himself, and Mark guested on a lot of, Mark E. Smith guested on a lot of his solo stuff. But they were very, very close. And he just, Ed's just like sort of the earth. He's just like a cool dude. He's just no airs and graces, but just very... He's got a man of great integrity, like such integrity that like is the cut through of everything. And yeah, he talked about working with Mark E. Smith in the studio, but also being with him just as he passed away. And, you know, as an interviewer, as an untrained interviewer, I'm like, I'm learning on the job. That was an interesting thing to be able to manage. And in regards to Mark E. Smith's passing, I interviewed Stuart Lee, and we did a lot about The Fall, and I wanted to frame it in a way, because he's spoken about The Fall a million times, but a lot of our listeners are listening in America. Like, hello to people listening to America, like a large percentage of people listening to America, and you won't know who Mark E. Smith is necessarily, or Stuart Lee. So I asked Stuart Lee specifically to explain who The Fall were, and then because he was kind of selling them for the first time in a different way, he kind of talked about them being, he said, the moment that The Fall don't exist would be the same as Manchester United not existing anymore to the normal person. Like, it's just something that's been there and it's, you know, in his whole life. So we recorded that episode. I was about to release it, and then Mark E. Smith died. So I text Stuart Lee and said, and I knew he was on stage at Leicester Square Theatre, and I said, I'm sure you've heard by now, in case you haven't, Mark E. Smith has passed away. I was due to release this episode talking about Mark E. Smith. Is it okay that you're happy for me to release it? And he said, sure, just send out whatever you need to. Just do whatever you need to. So I did like a little edit of that piece and sent, you know, released that as a kind of a standalone kind of couple of minutes as he's talking about him as a tribute. And then we released the full episode. But there's been a number of times during the podcast, like having to talk about quite difficult things and people passing, and it's an interesting thing to have to do as an interview. Like, so Mo Pleasure, who recently came on, he was with Michael Jackson like 5 hours before he passed away, and talks about how Michael Jackson was, you know, to the point where he still had his earpiece in from the rehearsal and could hear Michael Jackson laughing as he was getting into the taxi to go home. Yeah.
Wow.
And then when Michael Jackson passed away, they thought it was he was watching the news and saw the news that, is it Farrah Fawcett died the same morning? I think that's her name. And he was watching the same news broadcast that we were all watching. And Mo was like, this is a publicity stunt because Michael Jackson will want to move to a different... Yeah, to move to a different venue, whatever it might be. Turns up and realises there's police tapes everywhere. And he's like, realises it's what it is. And actually, you know, listen back to the interview, because there's a point where another band member says, I'm worried about Michael. The day before, who knew Michael, like, and I'm kind of doing kind of fingers interlocked here, knew Michael like that, said that the day before Michael died. And then the next day, the first thing he saw Mo and said, you know, I said that yesterday, I knew. And some people might not be aware of this, but the memorial show that they did, which was at the Staples Center, is where they'd rehearsed. So they basically said, look, the band, you've learnt all the songs, you know your stage positions, just stay where you are, and we're going to do a memorial show playing some of those songs with different people singing. But instead of having Michael in the middle of the stage, you're going to have his coffin and his body's going to be there. And so Mo talks about this moment where Paris Jackson, Michael's daughter, had to do a speech about her father, and he said that she was like 20 meters away and he absolutely kind of got choked up listening. But her ending that speech was his cue to play the intro to Man in the Mirror. And he said, that's something I played a million times, the dun, 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 on the chime bells. And he said he looked down, his hand was shaking because he knew there'd be like probably hundreds of millions of people watching, and he couldn't make a wrong note. And he knew that as soon as he played that, that was the cue for the Jackson brothers to pick up his coffin to walk him out.
Wow. Unbelievable.
So there's been some heavy shit that's gone on in the podcast. Yeah. Like friends of mine joke that it's like, I seem to interview a lot of people who have
on
been...
On the brink of something very tragic happening.
Yeah, like you look at the Visconti thing with Bowie and you know, the Mo and like Ed Blaney.
Do you think the podcast is a place that people of certain artistic sensibility feel safe on? You know, because I think my opinion of you as an interviewer is that you're not a qualified interviewer, which that doesn't mean anything. Like journalists, you're only qualified if you can talk to people. I mean, that's all a journalist is. So, someone who can have a rational conversation with someone and extract certain information that they can then turn into a story. But your approach to journalism, I know you don't like the word journalist, but your approach to journalism comes from an academic point of view in terms of your approach to psychology, your approach to digging deeper, understanding personality types, but also really understanding what drives people and what motivates people. And I think that's why the interviews are so compelling. I mean, I know that you do that naturally because it's an area that you're interested in, but did you think about that before you started the podcast in terms of approaching an interview from a psychological point of view, not to extract something maybe that is dangerous or difficult, but just in terms of making sure you get the most out of people's time in terms of having a chat to someone and getting something out of someone that's worthwhile for them and for you?
So by that stage, so it was 2015, I kicked it off. And by that stage, I was very much exploring and doing some work in the area of psychology. But I was only kind of at the early stages embarking on this. And I'm really glad you asked that question because it's just made me reflect and think, yeah, actually, that was what I thought could be a unique selling point. And I was like, do you know what? Being reflective thinkers and reflective practitioners and asking these questions that might unearth some stuff, that's what I do day to day with people so that they can progress and develop and get to where they need to, getting to root causes of issues, etc., etc., etc. So why don't I just do that with a load of musicians and see how I can unearth some juicy data that might be useful and a shortcut for a young musician to get the knowledge they need to get to where they want to get to. So, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I definitely did consider that subconsciously. And it was only the last couple of years that I kind of realised, oh, yeah, I'm doing that. And I should do more of that. And I should amplify that. And even now, listening to you talk about that and me thinking on this, is I should do more. How can I amplify that and do more of that? But essentially, you know, I always wanted people to walk away and think that that was a great interview, you know, the people I was interviewing. And, you know, I'm really proud. Like, so we do these supper club things where we get people who've been on the podcast to perform in our lounge. And I'm really proud that Mo Pleasure said to, like, a room full of people, he just went, like, Chris is without doubt the best interviewer I've ever been interviewed by. And I know that sounds a bit weird and a bit sickly for me to say that, but there's other examples.
Well, we said exactly the same thing when you interviewed us, and I didn't know you at that point, so I didn't know about the psychological approach. But a big thing for me was that, you know, we've been interviewed by some amazing, you know, Steve Lamacq, Dermot O'Leary, big people at the BBC, for example, and Carson Daly, like some big people in the States. Your interview was the best interview that we ever did, and it took us off guard slightly. The main reason was that we did get a little bit, and every musician you've ever interviewed will feel the same thing on a much bigger level compared to what we felt, but you get a little bit in a routine of, here's someone who's listened to a few of our songs, doesn't know anything about who we are as people. They might even have done a bit more than that and actually listened to the whole album, actually like the album, but they're not going to dig. So what we found was that one of the biggest things that really disheartened me was we got a 4-star review in Uncut magazine, and I loved Uncut. I'm talking over 12 years ago now.
Yeah.
Uncut magazine was a big deal. We got a 4-star review in Uncut magazine, and I found out that the 4-star was basically because our manager knew people there, and when I read the review, it was more or less the press release that we wrote.
Shit.
So the review was very short, but the review was essentially the press release. And nothing against Uncut magazine, because I think they're fantastic journalists who work for Uncut magazine, but ultimately, time-strapped, trying to do people a favour, trying to produce content, they just post it, they just put our review in. They just put in our press release as, this is what this band want to say about themselves, 4 stars. We were so disappointed because we felt like it was a 5-star record.
Yeah.
I would have rather a 1-star and some real critique than our own press release versus, you know, and a review. So when we met you and all of a sudden you were asking us questions, it wasn't about the songs, it wasn't about a sycophantic fan, it was about what makes you tick. Why did you write this? What inspired you to do this? Why did you do that? Why on earth would you stop playing music? What makes you want to stop playing music? Why do you want... It was about why. And all of a sudden, it was this... John and I from Gold Art Assembly walked away thinking, that was the best interview we've ever done, because we were challenged by someone who had, one, listened to the music, which a lot of the people we'd been interviewed by previously had listened to the music. We didn't have anything to say. They just led us down the path of, I've read in your press release that you want to say this. So, you know, James from Goldheart, you know, so where did you record the albums? Like, we got the press release, you know where we recorded it. You're asking me, because you're trying to lead me down a path. You didn't ask us that.
And that's very surface.
Us. Yeah.
Yeah.
No surface questions.
Yeah.
You asked us, why did you do this? What makes you tick? Why on earth would you want to do this? Why are you even here? Well, what are you even having this interview for? And I feel like that is a unique selling point. I know you're going to do more of it. And with that in mind, what's next for the podcast? What are you thinking in terms of where this can go? Because my gut thought is, I see the interviews that you're doing getting more and more and more away from the people that you've never heard of, and more and more towards names that you've heard of, even within a band, you know.
Yeah.
But I think both are important. I think it's amazing for the podcast that you're going to move towards potentially bigger names. But where do you see the podcast going, and why do you see it moving in the direction that it's moving in?
So I'm conflicted in the essence and the aim of the podcast is to tell the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success. So the bigger names is a bit of a thing that conflicts with me a little bit. But when you get people like, so, you know, Gail Ann Dorsey, who was David Bowie's bassist, who is then she's now bassist in the National,
total legend.
Like, messaging saying, I'd love to come on at some point.
And wow, because she's unbelievable.
So like, that is someone who is someone who's going to be coming on at some point. And like, you know, going back to the Gallagher, but Bonehead, like, has done a load of tweets recently, and people listening to this will know, done a load of tweets recently just saying how amazing the Stage of Podcast is and how much he loves it, and quoting episodes and quoting bits from episodes. Fucking fantastic. And so yes, you can get names, but I still feel that the purpose of the podcast and the credibility of the podcast will come from interviewing people. Like, so we've got Everton Nelson coming up, who's worked with you.
Yeah, I love Everton.
So Everton's a violinist who's played on pretty much every record you ever listened to, who,
and every major film soundtrack
ever. Yeah,
I asked Everton a couple of months before coronavirus lockdown, I asked Everton, I introduced him to someone and I said, oh, Everton, I said, this guy's a fantastic, he's a lead violinist, he works at Abbey Road. Everton, just tell them what films you've worked on recently. And he just reeled off the every Oscar-nominated film.
Wow.
It was, you know, Martin McDonagh's Three Billboards, it was Black Panther, it was, Everton's been on everything.
And
who's ever heard of him in terms of the general public? Like, within the industry, yes, but he has influential on so many things.
And what he's going to be talking about is he was the lead violinist on the new Bond movie song with Billie Eilish. And he's got a great video that he showed me in the Groucho Club that night when he asked his daughter... his daughter's a big fan of Billie Eilish, and he asked Billie Eilish, he said, I'll never get a video or photo with you, but I've never ever done this, but my daughter's the biggest fan of Billie Eilish ever, and can I get a quick photo on the piano at Abbey Road? And she went, no, you can't get a photo, you can get a video, what's her name? And Billie Eilish does this little video, and then does this video to camera, saying a name, and then just goes, your dad's the coolest guy in the world. And then, like, moves the camera so Everton's in shot, and now apparently he's like the coolest dad ever in a school. But yeah,
he's a cool dad anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So he's worked with everyone. So he's going to come on. Jeff Barrow and Adrian Utley from Portishead are both going to be coming on, and you know, so I see it going continuing the same direction. Do I want to interview people front and centre? I don't know yet. I know I've done that occasionally. We had the likes of Ian Brody on, etc., etc. But for me, then
he's an unsung hero in his own right.
Yeah,
I feel like you do successfully thread these people in. Ian Brody was a very unsung producer for Echo and the Bunny Man, yeah. And you know, as the interview touches on some, you know, he's an unsung hero. But
the Coral Zootons wouldn't exist. Yeah,
huge in the Liverpool scene.
Yeah.
Do you want to do more stuff like that? Do you want to bring more people to the forefront who are already at the forefront, who people maybe don't know what else they've done?
That's an angle. I like that. I might nick that off you, yeah. Yes, quite possibly. As long as it doesn't become the... it needs to have the unique element of... I want people to realise, anyone listening to this, that you don't have to be the superstar and front man to make a living out of the music industry and to play Wembley Stadium or play the O2... or whatever venue it might be, Madison Square Gardens, you could be sat next to that person on the tube and you have no idea who they are. So I would like to do more interviews of people who are stage left. That is the purpose of the podcast. But if someone approached me and said, will you interview me, and I'm the singer of a really well-known band, that'd be difficult to turn down.
Yeah, well, it is. So I'd just like to, just finishing up, I mean, as the person who really wants to champion the unsung heroes of the industry, look, moving forward with what the Stage Left podcast is going to be, you also have a whole new generation of people who are listening to the podcast who are, you might not acknowledge this, but possibly inspired by, here's someone who is able to talk to people in bands that I love and access people that, and while you might not acknowledge this, people will look at you and say, here's this super connected guy who can tap into whatever he wants to do and blah, blah, blah. And in the same way that you've acknowledged people who are stage left, who, you know, have just gone whole heart out and just worked on the projects that they love. What would you say to people who want to start podcasts now in terms of, I know you personally now, and I know that you're not this super connected guy who just knew everyone in the music industry, who could talk to anyone they wanted. If someone wanted to start a podcast now, doesn't matter what genre, doesn't have to be the music industry, how do you start off when you've got nothing and no contacts and no one to talk to, but you've got a great idea for a podcast? And I know that's a hard question to end on.
It's a hard question. It's like a ridiculous amount of resilience and a very, very strong motivational context as to why you want to do it. The mission statement of my podcast is there to almost act as an auditing and a quality assurance lookout, if you like. And you can lose sight of that. And I get a lot of people say to me, I'm thinking about doing a podcast, what should I do? And actually they book some good guests on and they do one episode and it's a feather in their own cap and they never do another episode. And those great people might be thinking, what the fuck happened with that? So the first thing is the podcast is not about you. And I know that's really like ironic that I'm doing this over like a hour and a half episode.
Well, 5 years in.
Yeah, 5 years in. But it's not about you. And do you know what? One of the proudest moments for me, and this is probably a good bit of advice, is that we featured on Fox... Actually, hang on, let me get this fucking right. I fucking hate Fox News and it's the worst thing in the whole world. But we featured on Fox News because a member of Guns N' Roses revealed something about an upcoming album and they started quoting us, etc., etc. And we were on Fox News for a bit. And off the back of that, we got a lot of journalists like wondering, oh, who's the Stage Left podcast? And one of the reviews was, I absolutely love this podcast, but the best thing about this is I have no idea what the name of the host is and he doesn't have a Wikipedia page and there is no profile about him anywhere. Yeah. And I think for me, if I was to identify one thing, and like, you know, Jim knows me better than anyone, I'm the least fucking modest person ever, but you want to make sure that you aren't the focus of your podcast, whereas most people starting out on a podcast will be like, I spoke to someone recently who got some fucking brilliant guests on like first episode podcast. And he's like, right, that's it. I've done it now. I've achieved that. I've like, you know, podcast. Yeah, I've done my podcast.
You could have said that 2 episodes in. Yeah, I've done my podcast.
I've done it. And it's just like, but why are you doing it? So in the same way, it's like a business has a mission statement. It's like, why are you doing this? What purpose is it? And, you know, I think the reason the podcast has had the people it has had on, it seems to have a, it's because I've always, and this is a really good point to end on, and this is just for anything in life, like integrity is priceless, right? So take someone like my dad, and I love my dad, but like he's someone who'd be like, how can we, you know, how come you aren't make, you know, could you have done what you've just suggested, Jim, and like just go straight to like big artists and maybe make some money out of it and go to a paper and go to, you know, and I, you know, the Guardian newspaper at one point were interested about me doing the podcast with them, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And you know, how can you make sure that the people you want to come on the podcast want to come on for the right reasons? And if you can build up something of integrity that cannot be penetrated by capitalism and capitalizing on certain situations, then people will start coming to you and people will, you know, you start, you know, asking people, okay, do you want to come on the podcast? Who have you had on? Wolfgang Fleur, Stuart Lee, Tony Visconti, Steve Cropper, bang, I'm already there. When are we doing it? It's about protecting that integrity that is so precious that I think a lot of us, in the pursuit of financial gain, can deprioritize at times, and that can be at the cost of the quality of what you release. So for me, if I, you know, I plan to do this podcast very, very long term. This is like a life project for me. And if I made, you know, if I had the opportunity to make loads of money out of interviewing people, but it'd be seen as a surface thing that we just talked about and was background music in a news agent's, or I could earn no money from it and do in-depth interviews that were reflective and people felt that as they walked away from them, that they would be maybe reassessing how they go about their creative processes. Or young musicians could listen and go, I'm going to steal that and that's going to help me go on my career. That's far more valuable than the first one.
Well, I think that's a fantastic point to end on. Chris Simpson, thank you so much for coming on the Stage Left podcast. You've been a fantastic guest and hopefully see you again on here soon.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Thanks a lot.